I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Tallahassee-based writer Bob Shacochist covered the U.S. military intervention in Haiti in 1994 as a journalist, and he used that experience as the springboard for his latest novel, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul. I will speak with Bob Shacochist about his novel and about Haiti. Also, as President Obama seeks congressional support for a military strike against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, I'll speak with Jabir Nerabir from the Syrian American Council's Orlando chapter about the situation in Syria and the impact of U.S. military involvement. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Bob Shacochist. Bob is a writer and journalist. He covered the Haitian uprising as a journalist in 1994. Currently, he teaches creative writing at Florida State University. Shacochist's latest book, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul, starts out as a murder mystery set in Haiti, and it broadens out to cover a time frame spanning from World War II all the way to Clinton's presidency. Bob, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
Now, you won a National Book Award for your 1985 short story collection, Easy in the Islands, and you also covered the U.S. intervention in Haiti in 1994. You spent time with the U.S. Special Forces in that country. What made you decide at this point to return to the Caribbean as a setting for the first part of your new novel?
Well, ever since I left the Caribbean, and I haven't been to Haiti for now 10 years, my imagination was haunted by an encounter I had in Haiti right as the occupation, the American occupation, was ending and the UN peacekeeping forces were taken over. I met, as it says in the first line of the book, a beautiful young blonde-haired photojournalist who seemed very disturbed. And one morning she came to my breakfast table and sat down and was sort of moody and grim and started asking me about voodoo. And she said, well, do you know a voodoo priest? And I said, yeah, I know plenty of them. And she said, will you take me to meet one? And I said, sure, I had nothing much going on that day. So I drove her an hour north into the countryside to meet a Hungan. Hungan is the Creole word for priest. To meet a priest at his temple out in the countryside. But on the drive there, she asked me if I believed in the soul and if I thought people could lose their souls. And she said, well, I've lost my soul. And, of course, that sounded like utter nonsense to me.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we got to visit the voodoo priest, her behavior became even more strange, as you'll see if you read the book. And that encounter, so that's the end of my autobiographical encounter and the modeling for this human rights lawyer named Tom Harrington in the book. So He's the guy who takes her to meet the voodoo priest so maybe she can get her soul back.
The character of this young photojournalist who comes to your human rights lawyer, Tom Harrington, and says, I've lost my soul. Do you know any voodoo priests? Can you take me to one? Some of these questions seem like the kinds of things that might pop up when somebody who doesn't know much about Haiti thinks about the country. They think voodoo. Is that kind of a cliche, do you think? You know, people think
It is a cliche, and that makes it hard to write about. And I already have had some responses at book signings or readings where certain people, usually middle-aged women, come up to me and say, oh my, they look at the jacket copy and say, and see the word voodoo and say, ugh, why would I ever want to read about voodoo? You know, that's a common reaction, but it's also because of Hollywood, an enormous cliche. And so there's a counterforce there that's a challenge as a writer to both be realistic about it but try to avoid all the cliches if that's possible. And, yeah, when she first asked me, do I know about voodoo, I thought, I've got her figured out.
Mm-hmm.
She's this type of spiritual tourist that comes or this spiritual voyeur who wants to see, you know, the savages dance or something ridiculous like that or sort of roll around in the mud with the possessed spirits. And I thought, gosh, you know, if you were coming to Haiti and you really wanted to know about voodoo, at least you would read a book or so before you came. But it turned out the voodoo thing was a total misdirection. in terms of her reason for connecting with this priest, mm-hmm. at least in the book. Mm-hmm. Why she did it in reality, I still have no idea. It's unfathomable to me what she was up to.
And your description of the encounter in this novel with the priest is, it's kind of interesting because your character, Tom Harrington, sort of, you know, she says, can you help me get my soul back? And he mm-hmm. says, yeah, there's a price, though.
Right.
And then your character, Tom Harrington, explains the different levels of, you know, what he'll have to do. And it's kind of a straightforward business transaction.
Right.
It'll cost you this much.
That's right.
You know, he's making a living as a...
That's right.
It's his job. There's a level of, in your description at least, of kind of practicality about it. It sort of goes beyond that superficial element of, you know, what you might think about when you think about voodoo if you don't know anything about it.
Right. Well, the fact is voodoo is at the center of Haitian culture, and Haiti's culture is its strength. For all those poor people suffering through centuries of abuse and oppression, voodoo plus Catholicism, sort of a hybrid of the two religions, but mostly voodoo, provided a theocratic view of the universe that comes intact with a moral value system. It's an ancient religion, most commonly referred to as animism, but it sees the divine in everything in the world, a tree, in the ocean, you know, in certain plants, in certain geographical spots. It's always finding the divine. So that's its theological connection. But most practically, it is a system for living together. Voodoo will tell you the priest will help settle a marital dispute, a land dispute, a robbery. It has all those rules that keep a society together. And I've always argued if those values, those good values, and like any religion, it has a dark side to it. I mean, nobody can tell me Christianity doesn't have a dark side, especially when its main icon is a crucified man. And nobody can tell me Islam doesn't have a dark side, Buddhism, Hinduism, they all do. And but most people involved in voodoo are, you know, they their main sensibility is lightness. Light, divine light, not darkness. But of course, there are a few bad guys too. But if those values of the village were ever institutionalized at the national level, and those values are really what's allowed Haitians to survive, Haiti would change in a minute. Mm-hmm. But the minute you say that to a place like the New York Times, which I did when the Times sent me to write about it in 1986. They said, well, we're not going to promote the values of voodoo as a reasonable political solution to the turmoil in Haiti. And I said, well, it's a grassroots level thing. And until the grassroots comes to the national palace, this country is going to be a very disturbed country. And in fact, a few years later, the grassroots movement called Lava Loss had their first democratic election in Haiti. And this priest who was complicated was arrested, and that was the grassroots coming to the national level.
Mm-hmm. Now, you served in the Peace Corps as well in the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
correct? Did you go into that with some kind of sense of idealism? What drove you to join the Peace Corps?
To go surfing.
Okay.
I mean, that would be a very, not just an honest statement, but a realistic statement. Too much idealism means you're going to bounce back rather fast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the statistic is now, but back in the 70s when I was in the Peace Corps, the burnout rate was pretty high. It's like 60%. And that's because you have young Americans, you know, coming out of college and coming out of the suburbs and being put in some of the most fascinating but challenging and primitive parts of the world. Sometimes they're very isolated from other Americans. Or other people of their race or gender, and you have to immediately build up a set of emotional and psychological skills that you were never asked to do in the suburbs or at the university. Most people join the Peace Corps because they want to make the world a better place. well, that's very nice. And some actually get to do that. But most people, like America itself, when America tries to make the world a better place, you know, we quickly arrive at that aphorism. I think it was Clare Boothe Luce who said it, that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. And you see unintended consequences, like we certainly have seen in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time you went to Haiti?
I went in 1986 at the behest of the New York Times Sunday Magazine to cover what was called the déchoucage, which is the Creole word for uprooting. And that was the revolution against baby Doc Duvalier.
So what was it like almost 10 years later? You went back to Haiti in 1994 to cover the
invasion,
The invasion.
Operation Uphold Democracy.
You spent quite some time with the special forces there. Describe that experience. How did that sort of change your view of Haiti, and did it change at all your view of the United States and how the United States goes about its foreign diplomacy?
It didn't change my view of Haiti. I've always thought Haitians are some of the sweetest, gentlest people on earth, and they've just had their asses whipped by so many forces over the years, including us. But we did invade Haiti ostensibly to restore an elected president, although when America promotes democracy all around the world, what they're mostly promoting are elections, and elections are a total illusion of democracy. And if somebody gets elected democratically that we don't like, we don't respond to that very well. So even Clinton, who reinstalled Aristide into the National Palace down there, was, you know, 4 years later, 6 years later, was, you know, sort of orchestrating behind the scenes another coup to get him out. And this, we can see this all across the Middle East right now with Hamas being elected legitimately in the Gaza Strip. And, you know, we can't, it was democratic, but we hate it. Our government hates that and would like to dethrone Hamas, no matter how democratic their elections were.
I'm speaking with writer Bob Shikochis. Shikochis went to Haiti as a journalist in 1994, and Haiti is also the setting for the first part of his new novel, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or Twitter. You can also email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I mean, America is right now debating the morals and logistics and what might happen if they get involved militarily in Syria. And in some ways, I wonder if there's a sense that it's easy to kind of forget that not long ago, you know, within the last 2 decades, the U.S. was getting involved in a military fashion in countries literally on its doorstep, like Haiti. Do you feel like Haiti has kind of fallen off the radar a little bit where U.S. foreign policy is concerned?
Yeah, it's really never on the radar, except for very real politic reasons or cynical reasons. For instance, when Clinton was running first against George Herbert Walker Bush, one of his campaign promises was to not interdict the Haitian refugees at sea and warehouse them in Guantanamo, which was what George Herbert Walker Bush was doing. But Clinton promised to bring them to shore here and give them asylum when he was a candidate. The minute he became a president, he reinstalled the program that Bush was doing. He was interdicting them at sea and sending them right back to their murderers. Now, this seems to me what Obama has done with George W. Bush's program with the War on Terror. He promised something different as a candidate, but he's more of the same as a president.
If I could just bring you back to Haiti and the book, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul. I mean, there is this, I think, conflict within the story, in the Haitian portion at least, where you have, you know, people with ideals, people wanting to do something good, and then a country that is resisting those efforts. If you look at Haiti now, and you haven't been back there for a while, but they still have some problems. They suffered a colossal and devastating earthquake not too long ago. What is the best course of action for a country like the United States, a huge, powerful next-door neighbor, to help a country like Haiti? Should they just step out of the way and let them get on with it? What's the best thing to do?
Yeah, now I am cynical. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the Clintons were just down there for photo ops. And all Clinton wanted to do as the special envoy appointed by the United Nations to help Haiti was to bring in sweatshop owners. That sounds pretty harsh, but he couldn't even do that. So, you know, every time I'd see a picture of Haiti, Clinton in Haiti, it made me very, very cynical, because he's the one who destroyed their economy with sanctions. You know, sometimes it's just best to leave these people alone. Even sending food hurts them, because that's another thing Clinton did. He said, we're going to ship U.S. rice to Haiti. And the rice farmers in Haiti were busted by that. They could no longer afford to grow rice, so there's no rice grown in Haiti anymore, and they used to be able to feed the entire country with their own rice. It's really difficult. I understand the complexities, the difficulties. What I'm cynical about is you can still get filthy rich from taking pennies from the poor. And there's a very rich ruling class in Haiti, and there are a lot of American and international businessmen who still make a lot of money off Haiti. And I don't know how you change that. I don't know how you change that in America as we become more and more a corporate state with money influencing so much that's negative in our society.
It took you 10 years to write this book. You've poured a lot into it, and not just your own experience, but as you were saying, you were thinking of a way to write it and how to kind of use some of those images that came across your radar and put them into fiction. Are you working on something now? Do you think it's going to take you 10 years to write your next book?
Oh my God, it better not. I turn 62 next week, and really, the idea of taking another 10 years to write a novel makes me nauseous, gives me vertigo. I've already sold, I've already written 50 pages of the next novel and have a contract for that. And I promised I would get it done in 3 or 4 years. Now, I have to say, I've always made that promise and I've always broken that promise. You know, sometimes I've broken 10 yearly contracts in a row. But that's just the way I am, I guess. No, it better not take 10 years. So there is another novel coming called The Magnificence of Everything That Burns, and as soon as I get off my book tour and go back to Tallahassee and start teaching, I'll start working on that a little bit more and doing research, going to Argentina because it's set in Argentina and Cuba. I think I've been to Cuba enough. I need to go to Argentina a little bit more.
I've been speaking with Bob Shikochis. He's a writer and journalist. He teaches creative writing at Florida State University. His latest book, The Woman Who Lost Her Soul, starts out as a murder mystery set in Haiti and broadens out to cover an entire time frame spanning from World War II all the way to Clinton's presidency. It took him 10 years to write the book. He hopes to take a little less time to write his next novel. Bob, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks a lot, Matt. I really appreciate it.
Up next, a conversation with Jaber Nerabia from the Syrian American Council's Orlando chapter about the situation in Syria and the impact of U.S. involvement. I'm joined in the studio by Jaber Nerabia. Jaber is the head of the Orlando chapter of the Syrian American Council. It's an organization that represents the Syrian community in Central Florida. Jaber, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start with some questions about the Syrian population in Central Florida. Now, your organization represents Syrians here in this part of the country. What's the demographic like?
In Central Florida alone, recently after the revolution, a lot of people started coming in. Just numbers alone say about close to 50 families came new. Mm-hmm. Before then, there was a good amount of Central Florida Syrians, but they weren't well connected to a point where you know exact number. But I'm going to say close to probably about 1,000 Syrians live in Central Florida.
How does that compare to Syrian Americans elsewhere in the country?
There's areas that they're more concentrated. For example, in Chicago and big cities, we're talking in the 50,000s and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But here in Florida, there is, like I said, a good amount. It's just you can't put a good number on them because not everybody knows everybody.
Let me backtrack a little bit too. I mean, the conflict in Syria began March 2011. It was part of the wider movement known as the Arab Spring. How does Syria fit into the Arab Spring? Because clearly it's not a homogenous movement across the entire Middle East. It's different in different countries. So how does Syria fit into that?
Correct. Actually, when it happened, a lot of people thought that will never happen in Syria because Syria is so, it's such a police state to a point you can't do anything. You can't start any kind of movement without being crushed completely by this brutal regime. So when it first started, it moved slowly. But as soon as the killing started, the killing from the regime against the civilians, it began from the initial point of the revolution. And it's known that whenever you kill somebody, 10 other people will come out to try to avenge for his life or just to speak out. And that's how it spread out in the Middle East. And one thing about what happened in Syria is the brutality that the regime used against the people from the beginning is much more than any other country.
Do you get the sense that the uprising could have happened without the Arab Spring in other countries?
Oh, no, definitely. It was when the Arab Spring started, it gave the people, when they saw other countries gaining strength and actually toppling their tyrants and their dictators, it gave people hope that we can do it here. As much as Syria, everybody said, it's going to be 10 to 20 times as harder than all other countries, it gave them hope, and that's where it started, and it started going along and actually getting some traction.
What about the way things are now? I mean, the reports from media suggest that there may have been a fairly cohesive opposition from the start, but you get the sense now that that's not the case. There are different factions within Syria, they all have different agendas. I mean, is there even a cohesive goal other than toppling the Assad regime at this point?
There is definitely, and this is something that's misrepresented in the media a lot. They keep talking about extremists, and they talk about people who have a very secular and somewhat of a very extremist agenda in Syria. But when we talk about numbers, just in estimates, we're talking about 6,000 to 8,000 extremists in Syria. And when it comes to the moderate opposition, it's 150 to 200,000, mostly army defections and people who, doctors and shop owners that picked up a gun to defend their city. So the reason we keep talking about extremists is because they're well-funded from other places, and the moderate opposition never really got any action from the international community. And the extremists, they are doing good social services for the people. So, and the people are in a desperate situation to a point where they'll take anything.
What countries are putting their influences into Syria at this point?
Well, Syria basically became the battleground between the Shiites and the Sunnis in a way. It's not a civil war. It's more of a genocide because Assad just kills anybody. He doesn't care. He just launches a dumb TNT barrel on a building and he doesn't know who's in it and just kills everybody. So it's mostly to that point. But when it comes to who has influences, it's basically Iran, Hezbollah, Russia. They have a great relationship with the regime. They're funding the regime. They're printing their money. They're helping them in any way they could. And when it comes to the opposition, you have the Gulf countries, the U.S., the West mostly. They're with the opposition. And it took them a while until they started saying, until the U.S. gave the green light to arm the opposition. But it happened. And it's taking a while until the U.S. is going to have some kind of influence to help the opposition. But again, we always say right now, it's better late than never.
Mm-hmm. At this point, though, what are you hoping the U.S. will do? Because there doesn't seem to be a lot of public support, even amongst the military in the U.S. Some folks are saying it would be a bad idea to get involved militarily in Syria. What do you hope the U.S. does eventually?
What we're looking for, I mean, at the beginning, we actually were asking for more than what was proposed, which is just about these limited strikes. But however limited they are, they will hurt Assad. Assad has a great advantage of air defenses. He has a lot of missile batteries that are just being launched chaotically on the people. So if the U.S. goes in and surgical strikes on the Assad regime, it will somewhat pave the road for the moderate opposition to advance. And I keep telling every American friend that I know is that this is not a war. This is a way to end a war that's been going on for 2.5 years. Syria does not want any troops on the ground. you probably heard no boots on the ground or any other term when it comes to Syria. The boots on the ground are already there. The opposition already has a plan to take over the government after these strikes come and hurt the defenses. There's going to be no American lives lost. This is all going to be from sea and air. So there's really no harm done here, and there's a lot of reports about the Gulf countries are paying for the bill. It's just the U.S. is going to come as the hero here.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible, though? You seem fairly confident that if the U.S. does not put troops on the ground, they can still have some influence that would end up toppling the Assad regime.
Oh, again, the biggest advantage that the Assad regime has is their air defenses. There's a lot of liberated areas in Syria that are completely liberated from Assad and his thugs. But when it comes to them organizing something, Assad has access to any area in the country with his fighter jets and his choppers. So as soon as the U.S. goes in with these strikes, hurts his defenses, hurts his missile batteries, it will give the rebels a chance to advance. Otherwise, if this stays the same as this, if this stays the same way it is now, this can keep going on for a very long time, actually several years, and the people who are hurt the most are just civilians.
Mm-hmm. At this stage, the president has put the decision of whether the U.S. will approve military action or not in the hands of Congress. He's getting some mixed reaction there. Are you confident that Congress will come through and back the president and authorize some kind of military action?
That's what we're hoping for. And we're actually we're being very optimistic about a different issue, what's happening in the Senate. They're actually trying to change the resolution to make it in a point where we're not just hitting Assad with these limited strikes. We're hitting them we're making them robust enough to help the opposition gain some ground. So I think at the end of the day, yes, we will have the vote from Congress, and they'll see that there's actually a huge benefit for the U.S., a huge benefit for the U.S. security in the here and in the region. And as much as we keep talking about it, it's all in their hands, and we're hoping that they'll get to a point where they'll see the benefits out of it. And another thing that we've been doing as Syrian American Council and Syrians in general in the U.S., as soon as we heard this kind of decision was coming, and as soon as we heard that he's going to ask for authorization, we started calling Congress, we started advocating, lobbying Congress in D.C. and elsewhere, and we had some good reactions from a lot of representatives that saw that there's a huge concern for this issue, and actually they were on the fence, not knowing, they were undecided, and changed their mind to yes.
Do you think President Assad can hold on to power without the U.S. getting involved?
He's actually gaining some ground, and this is how sad it is in Syria, is that the intervention from other countries and from other groups like Hezbollah, who we consider a terrorist state, a terrorist organization, Iran, their intervention inside of Syria is giving him some ground, his advantages, like I said, of all the military power, to a point where he recently took over some land back. So if it gets to a point where there's no help to the real opposition, to the civilians, this can escalate much, much more than it is now.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Jaber Narabia. He's the head of the Orlando chapter of the Syrian American Council, representing the Syrian community in Central Florida. We've been talking about the conflict in Syria. Jaber, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.